Session number 10602, Reel 22.
Reel 22. You were describing the various battle honour days, I think, for the regiment. Did every regiment have such a day, do you think, in the Durhams?
Well, every battalion in the Durhams would have a particular day which they would celebrate. Now, at home, the regimental depot, their train of recruits, would always take the day of the battalion on home service. Not the battalion on foreign service, but they would take the home service battalion's day. Now, when I enlisted, the 1st Battalion was at Catterick. So we celebrated November the 5th as celebration day. And then, when I joined the 2nd Battalion, we did Hooge Day, which was a different day altogether. And the same type of thing. Now, when you're in the home station, you've got a gymnasium where you can have an all-rangs dance, and the colours are brought out. That is the only time in the year, other than on a special parade, which the colours are uncased and they're on show.
Oh, where would they be shown?
They'll be taken to the gymnasium. And there'd be two colour sergeants, or a colour sergeant and a sergeant, guarding them. Fixed bayonets. Why?
Was this done when you were out at Khartoum? Would the colours be with you there?
The colours would be shown that day somewhere. I cannot quite recall where. But the colours would be on, would maybe have been on a parade or shown one that day. But I wouldn't guarantee that. But at home, yes, always. The depot, I'm not sure the depot colours, which was classed, I think, as the 3rd Battalion, but the colours were shown, and a sergeant and a colour sergeant was guarding them and would be relieved by other sergeants at the time. They were always guarded by sergeants and colour sergeants. And in the battalion, you would have a gymnasium there almost in every station, and you'd invite civilians in for the dance.
Did this happen at Khartoum with civilians?
No, there was no dance there, no dance. There was no facilities for dance. Anyhow, the heat made it that you couldn't. No.
Okay, thanks. We've looked at various aspects of recreation. Were there any others that you could do? Did you go into Khartoum and look around there? Was that?
You could have gone if you'd wanted to.
Did you ever do that yourself?
I never went in. I never had the time. Well, when I say I never had the time I was off duty was too late. So I maybe have gone in once, but I cannot recall ever going in. I know I've passed through it in the vehicle, but not to stop in the place. I don't think there's much there anyhow. I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
How long did you stay at Khartoum for?
About 9 or 10 months. It was short stay.
And you always stayed in that particular barracks? You
didn't? Oh, yes.
Go to any of the other...
I didn't,
stations?
Yeah. There was a detachment at Adbara, which was about halfway, I think, between Khartoum and Port Sudan, the Red Sea. But that was company duties. And with me being batman to the adjutant stayed at battalion headquarters all the time. So I stayed at battalion headquarters all the time.
Right. Where did you move to following departure from Khartoum?
We came to Port Sudan, where we embarked, and we came to Southampton disembarked at Southampton, entrained, and we got to Woking at the I think it's Inkerman Barracks there, between St John's and Knapheill. There's a barracks, but it's classed as Woking.
And this would be what year?
Towards the end of 1937. I was home for Christmas 37.
So that's the first time you've been home for how many years?
From 32.
Can you remember your reception when you got home? What?
It was a bit sad, really.
In what way?
Well, before we left the Sudan, I had received a letter from my next brother, who was between 15 and 16 years of age. And he wrote to me asking if I would try and get him into the army. And he said he'd try to get into the Royal Navy as a boy. But the petty officer who was interviewing him at Hartlepool, he must have been from the London area, because there was a mixture of understanding between the one word. The petty officer asked my young brother to spell the word bout. Well, bout to a northerner is B-O-U-T, as a wrestling bout or a boxing bout. But what the petty officer was wanting to know was B-O-A-T, boat. What we said boat, he was saying bout. And of course my brother spelt it as bout, as he was pronouncing it. And he failed him on his test for that. So he wrote to me asking me, he said he didn't want to remain in the mines. And he was having a bit of a time at home, which, you know, my enlistment was through domestic. And he asked me if I would try and get him into the army or do something for him. Now I wrote back to him and I said, I have enough money saved up, because I was saving a little money up to get married when I came out, at the end of my service. And I said, if you don't want to go to work anymore in the mines, don't, and I'll pay your wages for what you'd have earned when I get back home. I said, I'm coming home very soon, so don't go to work if you don't want to, and I'll say that you, whatever wages you had, I'll pay. And then we'll see your father and sort things out with him. Well, my boss, Mr. Jeffries, had a dog. And after I'd sent this letter away, on one day, this dog gave an awful howling sound, which was known as the death owl. Now, I approached Mr. Jeffries, and I said, have you anyone seriously ill at home? And he said, no. He said, why do you ask? I said, well, your dog has been given the death owl. And he told me not to be a fool. He said, that's only superstition. I says, it isn't. I said, either you or I, the two people close to that dog, or look after it, is going to receive word of a death. So he says, don't be daft, Elliot. That's only superstition, he says, and if you believe that, you'll believe anything. And I was persistent in this with him at that particular time. I says, but sir, I said, if someone close to you does die, I said, will you tell me, to ease my conscience? Because I said, if it isn't going to happen to you, it's going to happen to me. And he couldn't accept that statement. He thought it was being a bit daft. Well, I came home, as I've just said, we came home, and I didn't go with Mr. Jeffries to his home, because I was going straight on leave overseas. You know, when you come back from overseas, you've got 56 days leave, disembarkation leave. And I got me leave, I got me pay, and handed me equipment and everything else in what I wasn't going to bring on leave. And I travelled home. That was within the same day as we arrived at Woken, the same night I was on my way home. That was that quick. You know, everything was ready at the barracks. All it was just handing your kit into the stores and receiving your PA and ration allowance and everything else. And you didn't get a warrant, you had to pay your own fares those days. And but you had to have a pass, which if you showed at the railway station, you got about a 30 fare. So you paid about a third of the fare, and you got a time, you know, limitless, more or less. Anyhow, I got to Durham station, walked down from the station, it was late at night, and there wasn't a bus home to where I was going. Anyhow, while I was in the bus station trying to find out where I could get a bus near to home, as near as possible, there was a lad there, and I didn't realise who he was at the time, but there was a civilian standing, and he says, why? He said, there's a bus going to Sherburn Hill or Sherburn Village. Now he says, they can get that and walk through the fields. He says, I'm going that way and I'll get around with the gear. I said, all right, thanks. And when I actually got to see his face, he'd been a lad I'd been sitting beside when I was at school, only he had moved from Wheatley Hill to the next village while we were still at school. But I know the lad, they called him John George Newton, so I mean, I know his name even now. And we got off and he didn't say a word. You know, we kept talking about everything, about the past and where I'd been and about him and what have you. And we're walking through the fields in about midnight at night. And then when we got to Thornley, he explained to me where the street was, where I was going, because I'd left Wheatley Hill and my aunt had was moved, got married and lived in Thornley. So he told me where the street was, and you know, I found the street. And when I went in, I found out I'd arrived home on the day of my brother's inquest. He'd been killed in the mine on the day the dog had howled.
Did you ever tell Mr. Jeffries of this?
Well, after leave, I went back. I says, I'll bet you didn't have any news of a death in your family. He says, you're not bringing that up again. I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, why? He says, I told you it was nonsense. I says, my brother was killed the same day that dog howled in the mine. He wouldn't believe, he'd hardly believe it. But that's true.
Can you tell me a little bit about your leave at home? What sort of things did you do? I mean, obviously it was a very sad time to arrive. And
well, it was cold. And coming from a country where the temperature had been 127 in the shade, and just having a massive dose of malaria, my uncle was a miner, and they had a nice big fire, and I was sitting as near to that fire as you could get, and I was blistering and couldn't feel aid. I was so cold when I got home. Anyhow, I had permission to wear civilian clothes. I had a pass to wear civilian clothes. Since I hadn't got any, I set out with the money I had and saved, and I bought myself some civilian clothes and overcoat, and visited my friends I had. I found the friend, the lad I'd worked with, a marrier, if you like, as they called them at the pit. The lad was my marrier. He'd got married and a family, and more or less didn't want to know. You know, he made me welcome, but that was the end of that, because he was married and had a family to look after, where I was still single. And then I visited relations of my late wife. We still, at that time, my wife and I were still not allowed to meet openly. And I visited her aunt, the first place where I'd met Aunt Annie, as I used to call Aunt Annie, Uncle John. And Aunt Annie said to me, she said, well, what are you doing about Irene? I said, well, it's not what I'm doing. I said, it's what a father and mother are doing.
Irene was your girlfriend?
Was my young lady who became my wife. And Aunt Annie said, oh, this is all nonsense. She says, I'm going to write. She said, I've got three daughters. She said, I wished you were marrying one of them instead of messing around with the other one, you see. She said, you'd have been made welcome in this house any time. And they were Catholics, and, you know, and I wasn't, and they knew that. So she wrote to Irene's mother. They then had a business in South Shields, and they were living at Spennymoor. He used to go around, and he had around the shows and the race meetings, selling confectionery and cigarettes and what have you, you know, on trays. The lads, the Irene's brothers, used to go around with the trays around the neck, you know, selling like they used to in those days.
So what was the outcome of this letter that your auntie wrote?
Well, I got a letter asking me to meet Irene's mother at the shop in South Shields. So I went to South Shields, and when I went, Irene was helping in the shop. but she was told to go and take a walk. She wasn't even allowed to be present while the mother and I were talking. And the mother and I had a chat and lasted a while. Then Irene came back. I had my tea with them. And she says, I'll tell father what's happened. This was mother-in-law, humiliated mother-in-law, Irene's mother. She was a nice woman, and but a staunch Catholic. And for that Christmas, I received a letter, an invitation to meet the family and at the Christmas party where all of the family got together. They were a large family. So I went to Spennymoor and I met the family. And I found that the two younger lads were all in my favour and one or two of the younger girls were a little bit in my favour. But there was still that offishness, you know, but I was accepted anyhow. I'd been accepted into the house. That was got me tore through the door, if you like. And I was allowed, she was allowed to come and see me back to the bus. So we'd broken everything. And while I was waiting for that bus, I said, well, you know, now the permission seems to be coming. I've got to serve until August 39, that was the following year. But I'll be saving up from now on. And we'll arrange to get married in 1940.
Right, so having now become engaged, perhaps unofficially engaged to your future wife, during your disembarkation leave, was there any opportunity for you to meet with the other parts of your family that you were estranged with, your father?
Well, I never met them again, or the stepmother. But I did meet my brother and sister, the two that were left alive, the original family of five. I met them at my aunt's. They came to my aunt's where I was living, where I was spending my leave. Well, I always called it home, so, you know, seeing living with them, that I was more or less back home.
Did they ever try and encourage you to go and meet your father?
No. They knew what my personal views had been from the beginning. And although from time to time, while I was overseas, I'd sent sums of money home for to buy my brothers and sisters either shoes or to assist in buying them clothing or something like that. And that money used to go to my aunt, who was, more or less taking my mother's place, if you like. And the money was sent to her, and she bought my brothers and sisters either a pair of shoes or socks, or whatever the money would buy at the time of what they needed. I couldn't send too much because I was only on then, I think it was 3 shillings a day. And with all your normal commitments in the forces, your gear and whatever you had to buy, you didn't have a lot to spend. But being a non-drinker and a non-smoker, I was able to save a little bit. Not a great deal, but I saved a little bit.
Point of now, your return to Woking.
Aye. Well, after leave, I returned to Woking just for that one day, and then the boss, Mr. Jeffries, picked me up and took it to his home, which was living out of barracks. I was living like a civilian then, although I was wearing uniform and overalls. I was living about 7 miles away, I think it would be, from Woking in Mr. Jeffries' private house. And I was just carrying on looking after Mr. Jeffries' home and family and helping in the cleaning and whatever you like, the services of the house.
Was your daily routine living in a house different to that of your duties as a batman, for example, in
Well, yes, because it was a bigger house and there was different cleaning and whatever you had to do in the house.
Did you have to clean the whole house? Was that your responsibility?
Well, I used to clean parts of it with the cook general. Yes, the two of us used to do the whole house. Clean it. The cook used to do the cook, and I used to sometimes assist with the vegetables or what. But I waited on at all meals. Breakfast, lunch, tea and dinner. I had 4 meals. And I was there responsible for seeing to all that every day.
Did you have to drive Mr. Jeffries into the camp?
No, he had his own car and he used to drive himself in. I hadn't got a licence, so I couldn't drive. And I never got the opportunity to finish that driving course off, even at Woking. Because at that time, I was with Mr. Jeffries until around the middle of 1938. And as I think I've explained previously, he went to the Territorial Army as an adjutant and I came into barracks.
Did you live all the time with Mr. Jeffries before he became an officer of the Territorials?
No. For a period of time I was with him until they got the established staff, and then there wasn't a spare room for me in the house. But they did get a room for me with civilians in the village.
So they were your billets then?
So they were my quarters. One room, I had a small room, where a single bedroom, a very small room. But I was never, you know, I only slept in the room. I used to get up one morning, leave, and I didn't come back till night, late at night. So I only used the room really to sleep in, and just to stow me kit, my kit bags and rifle, what have you, my equipment was just stowed there in the house.
Did you have plenty of opportunities to get leave from the Jeffries house
You only got leave appertaining to the normal leave which was given to the rest of the battalion.
Yes, I don't mean leave from the whole camp area. I just mean to get out of the house.
I was on Saturday afternoon. I went up to see the village football team. The first Saturday I was available free. I went up to watch the village football team, and one of the members of the people running the team welcomed me to the ground. I found it rather strange, you know, but seemingly they known I was living in the village and they wanted to make themselves known, and I think they were looking for footballers as well, like. So, and he said, what do you think about the game? I says, oh, it's not bad, which it wasn't for a small village. They were playing well. And he said, can you play football? I says, oh, aye. He says, are you any better than any of them on the field? I says, well, there's a few better than me, but I says, I think I'm better than the majority of them that's on the field. I can play football. Will you play for us then? So, you know, I knew from the beginning that it was a catch. I said, oh, I'll have to ask permission. I said, I cannot play football for anybody without the CEO's permission. He said, well, if the CEO gives you permission, he said, would you play for us? I says, oh, I went out and get out. I said, I kind of get off every Saturday, you know, but I said, I'll put it to my boss when I go down tonight, and I said, I'll see what he says. So, as there was an order out in those days, moral rearmament was a big thing in those days, I think you would find out. That big tennis player was the man that was shouting about, what was his name? Went to America.
Fred Perry.
He was moral rearmament, and there was one wanting people to take part in sport. And we had a notice published, you know, that no soldier must play if a civilian can play, because there was ample facilities for the soldiers in the camp, in all camps. So I saw Mr. Jeffries and I told him what had happened. He says, well, can they turn 11 players out every week? I says, by what I understand, they cannot. They haven't got that many lads in the village. And they've already got one or two coming in. One was an ex-RAF lad. And they used to come in and make the team up whenever they could. So he says, well, I'll see the CEO on Monday and see if he can have permission. He says, I'll have an interview with the CEO. And when he came back on the Monday night, he said, yes. He said, the CEO's given you permission to play. But if there's 11 civilians, you mustn't play. Well, you know, 7 miles from barracks. Anyhow, I saw the lad, and I said, I can sign on for you, if you want me to sign on. I said, I've got permission from the CEO to play. Oh, he says, champion. So he had the forms there and then. But he says, there's one thing you have to do. You have to be a member of the Working Men's Club. Now, there was two clubs there, either a Working Men's or a Working Man's. I don't know the difference, but one of them There was two clubs opposite side of the road, but one run the football team, the village team. So I joined the club, the workman's club. I had to be nominated by someone and seconded by somebody else. Anyway, I became I became a member of the club, and I signed on and became a member of the football team.
So that was your recreation?
That was my recreation, where I didn't get into barracks. But you see, Mr. Jeffries had also said he would keep his eye on regimental orders, battalion orders, to see if I was named for any particular engagement, sport, or if parades or anything, if my name appeared in the orders, because I never saw them. I was, you know, living out of barracks. I never saw a battalion order or a company order. But once a month, I had to go into barracks to sign me accounts. And that was the only time I would ever know if I'd been wanted for anything, if Mr. Jeffries didn't get to know for me.
Did you feel very isolated in that sense, because you didn't see any of your fellow members of the Durhams?
Oh, well, I'd made friends with the villagers, and I was accepted in the one house like a member of the family. Now, you know, when you hear this northern south ballyhoo that goes on, I was welcomed in a home down there. I was like a son. But as I say, I played in 9 positions for that village team. There was only 2 positions that I refused to play, and that was centre forward and centre half. But the other 9, goalkeeper and everywhere else, I played.
When you learned of Mr. Jeffries' promotion and the fact that he wouldn't obviously be his batman anymore, and that would mean that you would leave that village, were you at all saddened by that?
In a way, yes. Because I'd became part of 2 families, if you like, while I was there. I'd became part of the Jeffries family in a kind of way, and I'd became a friend of the Pullen family. Although I was friends with a lot of the villagers, they always used to speak to me, so don't think I'm separating one from the other. But I was a wee bit saddened at having to leave the village where I'd lived in from coming from abroad.
Did you get any token of thanks from the Jeffries family at all?
I was always wished, you know, when they left, we shook hands, and he wished me all the luck that was going, you know, and I wished him every success. Because this does happen, you know. Servicemen in the between the wars, they were always moving. You know, you could be talking, you could make a friend one day, and they would be posted the next. And when I say posted, that included officers as well as other ranks.
So it was something that you came to accept.
You come to accept it. You may not like it at that moment in time, but you accept it, you know, because you've been used to one way of life. Now you've got to come back to your normal life of soldiering.
Yeah. Now, following this end of part of your career, you returned to the barracks now at working, didn't you?
Yes.
Did you have any particular duties now?
Just normal general duties, whatever came up, any normal parade or any fatigues. We didn't do guards there, I don't think. They may have done, but I can't remember doing a guard at Woken. The police were nearly on duty there.
Did you have any special training to do there?
No. There was 2 new weapons was talked about when we'd come. One was the Bren gun, and the other was the boys' anti-tank rifle. Now, we were told about them, and it was mentioned from time to time in orders, if you like, but I never saw one. They were mentioned, but never saw one. And in 1938, when our annual weapons course came up,